Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. We're going to be talking about Planet of the Apes today, so that means that Word Balloon switches to its alternate title of Ape Talk. That's right. Welcome back to Ape Talk. This is John Suntress. Boom Studios, Planet of the Apes comic book debuted this week, and it sold out its first printing. So congratulations to Boom. Congratulations to the creative team, including writer Daryl Gregory, who is our guest today. We'll be talking about the direction he is taking the Planet of the Apes franchise in the Boom comic book. It's sticking to the classic film continuity, but its starting point is a great place to start, fertile ground, and very interested to hear his ideas and directions that he has for the Planet of the Apes series. We get into that on this edition of Word Balloon's Ape Talk. Today it's brought to you by the Word Balloon T-shirt. Now, if you haven't seen it, it's a fantastic T-shirt that Tim Seeley designed. I'm very pleased with the way it turned out, and it is available to you at the very nominal price of just $20, plus $3.95 of shipping and handling. We have sizes from small to 4X, and if you need it, don't worry about the plus sizes, because we don't charge extra for plus sizes here at WordBalloon.com. Everybody gets a T-shirt for $20, $3.95 shipping and handling. Please allow 4 to 5 weeks for delivery, just because some of the sizes are starting to run out, and I just have to go back to the T-shirt guys and order some new ones, so it takes a couple extra weeks to kind of get that going. So thank you for those who have purchased it, both at C2E2 and so far online through PayPal at WordBalloon. And it is available to you if you come to our website, wordballoon.com. Do yourself a favor. Do me a favor. Pick up a T-shirt today. And thank you. Now let's talk to Daryl Gregory and enjoy some Ape Talk here on Word Balloon. So what led you to write this Planet of the Apes book for Boom Studios?
Well, I blame it on Chris Robertson. He's the one who got me into comics recently. I come from a science fiction and fantasy prose background, so I've been writing books, and Chris Robertson comes from that background. And I was completely jealous of Chris's career in comics. I became friends with Bill Willingham and Paul Cornell. I basically fell in with a bad crowd and started hanging out with those guys. I'm like, man, I'd love to do comics, because I've been a comic book geek since probably birth. And so Chris had handed the people at Boom my first novel, and they said, hey, you want to do this this Dracula comic we're doing that Kurt Busiek has come up with the storyline for? And so I started doing that for them, and that Dracula Company of Monsters is a book I'm doing with them right now. And then back in November, Matt Gagnon, the editor-in-chief now at Boom, called up and said, you know, we've got this chance to do Planet of the Apes. Would you at all be, you know, interested? Is that something attractive to you? And I was like, well, for me and people my age, you know, the Planet of the Apes movies are sort of burned into your consciousness. I mean, I think if someone says to you, you know, get your hands off, or my first response is to say, you damn dirty ape.
Absolutely.
It's like, it's an automatic response. And so, but the kicker was, he said, look, we can do anything in the classic mythology, so not relating to the chronology of the Burton film or tying into that universe, or in the reboot that's coming up with James Franco, the Rise of the Apes movies coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, we can do anything we want in that universe, any time period. Is there anything you want to do there? And I said, well, let me think about it. Because at first I had no ideas whatsoever. And then within 24 hours I had an outline to him. I'm like, okay, this is what I want to do. And they went for it. So I'm thrilled.
That's fantastic, man. You know, HBO, I noticed the multitude of HBO channels have been showing the original five in the last couple months. And in fact, I think Sunday I saw Escape from the Planet of the Apes, the third movie. And
I've been on a rewatching campaign myself, because I was watching them on HBO and they kept showing. I kept seeing the original movie.
Yep.
With good old naked Charlton Heston and his manly chest. And so then I've been watching all the Blu-rays over and over again. And it's great to have this kind of thing as homework to, you know, explain to my family. No,
sure.
I gotta watch more Apes movies. I'm sorry, honey.
Well, and I know, too, in 2009, when Boom got the license from Fox and they started working together, it was at WonderCon, actually, 2 years ago. And I remember being at the panel in which they made the announcement. And then immediately, Matt Brady from Newsarama and I were bugging Ross Ritchie and saying, okay, you know, Planet of the Apes. And he's like, not yet, but hopefully soon. And it took 2 years, but I'm glad we're here, because you know, again, I think it's such a great period, the original films in particular. So I don't think that's any problem. And plus, I would imagine you're at least aware of, if not having already read, a lot of those great black and white Marvel magazine Planet of the Apes stories as well.
Yeah, I read those back when they came out.
Attaboy.
And then a lot of the true fans out there, because there's a real active fan community who've been, you know, who've never stopped, you know, discussing all things Apes. They were asking me about all even the Malibu Comics, Mr. Comics, or all these comic editions that have come out over the years. And I had to tell them, I'm like, I've been avoiding reading any of those. I missed them when they came out, and I've been avoiding reading them because I don't want to be influenced. So for me, it's basically the movies of the canon that I'm going off of.
Okay.
And just trying to stick to those. But I did read those, those Marvel black and whites, which I thought were so cool.
Yeah, well, and it was just so much fun. And just basing it on just the two cover images, it kind of reminded me of some of the stories that Doug Munch and some of the other writers would come up with for Marvel in terms of that period of time before the first movie. And also, you know, it's the Planet of the Apes, and they would come up with goofy ideas like, you know, an island that was still, it was all apes, but they were kind of doing a King Arthur's Court kind of riff and everything. And it was.
Right. I think he had, like, at one point they find a riverboat captain who's like a New Orleans riverboat ape who's got a human woman with him. it was just all over the place. The time period I'm doing is after the last, you know, there's this complicated mythology with the apes. So after the last movie, there's this kind of coda with John Huston as the lawgiver talking to a bunch of apes and humans saying, and now we live in this society where apes and humans are living together in harmony. And they sort of say, well, what will the future hold? And he's like, only the dead know. And it's kind of the screenwriter, Paul Dean, he sort of intended it to be ambiguous about whether you're going to end up in the future with, you know, where Charlton Heston visited in 3954 or something.
Right.
Where it's all, you know, where humans are going to be, you know, mute savages. Or will you have a different open kind of chronology where anything can happen?
Sure.
And so we're sort of playing around with that because the characters themselves don't know whether they're, you know, whether destiny is hardwired or not. But what I'm fooling around with is, well, this is what I really liked about the Apes movies. You see those original movies, and probably more than any other science fiction franchise, they're wearing their hearts on their sleeves. I mean, the metaphors are crystal clear. They're talking about racism. They're talking about war. I mean, they're talking about 1968 and 71 and 72.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're being absolutely clear about it. And so for me, the only reason to do those is not to recap that, but to figure out, okay, what is, you know, what is the things that are bothering me personally, and what are things going on right now in this kind of post 9/11 environment that we could talk about, you know, use the Apes universe to talk about what's important to us now. And so that's sort of the theme of this book, is you've got these humans, you've got these apes, and they're the apes of the overclass, the humans of the underclass, and living in a ghetto called Skin Town. And you've got this question of, well, is this utopia at all possible? How do you deal with freedom versus security? The apes, you know, want to have the civilization, but the humans don't seem to be wanting to participate. And so it's basically one of the big questions is, what are the limits of violence? If you're unarmed and apes have all the guns, are you willing to cross the moral line to use, you know, explosives and terrorist acts? Or, you know, what are the lines that the characters are willing to cross and which ones won't they cross?
That's fantastic. And I think there is such a great blank space between where Battle for the Planet of the Apes ends and then, as you say, going to 3950 or whatever it was when
You've got 1,300 years, I think, is the spread.
Sure. You know? And yeah, I mean, you know, as you say, the scenes with the lawgiver at the beginning and the end of battle, there's a statue of Caesar, but we don't know how many hundred years it is past, you know, Caesar's attempt right after conquest to form a proper apes and human society and where things devolved. Also, all of the mysteries that are there in that first movie that really don't get explored in terms of how big is the Forbidden Zone? And, you know, where did, you know, all of these scrolls and the Ape Bible, essentially, that warns of man and stuff and all the warnings, you know, where did these ideas come from? So that's a real fertile area to kind of explore and set up things that eventually obviously get paid off, you know, in the form of Dr. Zaius and the religion that he adheres to in the first movie.
Yeah, and you've got this question about there's two different kind of lawgivers. There's this John Huston character who seems to be a very benign Moses kind of character.
Absolutely, very inclusive guy that's including humans and apes. They're there together listening to him.
Yeah, and then you have all these scrolls in the future where it's like, you know, beware the beast man, he's the devil's pawn, and you've got this fundamentalist guy. So the question is, okay, is this... what's happened here? If it's a closed loop, did those teachings get perverted or changed, or are we in a completely different timeline? And we'll get to play with all that stuff. But I'm really interested in the fact that the lawgiver scene, I think, takes about 600 years after the events of Caesar in battle.
Okay,
and so that's sort of the time period there, and. And so now these characters, Caesar and even Cornelius and Zira and all those folks, they're almost like founding fathers. And I like this idea of the fact that different political groups would be taking different lessons from them, you know, about whether violence is useful, not useful, because the movies were having this conversation all throughout, especially in Conquest. You see this where, you know, the famous... remade ending. You know, the first ending is Roddy McDowell is going to bring the smackdown on all humans.
Yep.
And then that tested so horribly that they said, wait a minute, we'll dub in a nice consolatory ending where he says, no, we'll put our guns away and we won't club everyone to death right now.
Well, and again, I mean, you can appreciate it in the shadow of, you know, the riots and the turmoil of the late 60s and early 70s. Maybe it was too harsh to kind of have that kind of ending at that time. It's such an incredible movie. I remember as a little kid, it being out and, you know, like my parents even being like, yeah, maybe that's a little too strong for you and stuff. Maybe we should wait on that one. So
I remember watching Beneath the Planet of the Apes on TV and on WGN in Chicago. Which,
there you go.
I swear WGN played The Treasure of the Sierra Madre and Planet of the Apes in sort of a constant rotation with the Dirty Dozen. It seemed like every weekend I was watching those movies. And I remember seeing for the first time Beneath the Planet of the Apes when the mutants take off their faces.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, that gave me the willies.
Oh, me too, man.
I don't think at that age I'd seen anything that scary. And it was like probably 4 o'clock in the afternoon and on a Saturday. You know?
Well, and I don't know if you're old enough to remember. I'm in my 40s, but back
even before. I'm in my 42, so we probably are on the same wavelength.
Okay, then you remember Ape Week on the afternoon movie, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
On Channel 7.
I know all of them back to back.
Yeah. And, that's the thing. And, it really was this big, even, you know, pre-Star Wars. You got to hand it to whoever was in charge of merchandising at Fox because, you know, everyone points to Star Wars as being the first big merchandising push. But really, Planet of the Apes, like, you know, back in the late 60s and early 70s had them beat.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the lunch boxes were out. It was a huge thing.
You could buy masks.
Somebody asked me when I first saw the movies, and I don't – so I was born in 65. I don't remember the first time I watched them. They just seem to be always be there.
Well, 68 is when the first one obviously came out. And I remember there was a film distribution company based in Chicago called Films Incorporated that would – you could get films for libraries and schools – and, you know, really, actually, even individuals could sign up if they had 16-millimeter projectors. And I remember going to a friend's parents' house, and we saw Planet of the Apes in their home. And it wasn't a VCR. It was on a 35-millimeter or 16-millimeter projector. And it was awesome.
Great.
Oh, and then really, that's the first time I saw it. And I know I wasn't more than 6 or 7 years old, so... This was like 70, 71. And then, of course, as you say, Channel 9 used to show them. CBS used to show them on late-night movies all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, no, the Ape movies were just all over the place. Plus that, even the TV show, which wasn't bad for its time. You know, I think right. it just had tough competition, but that used to be on Friday nights, and Roddy McDowell came back for that, and that even had some interesting ideas.
But you're right. This is the first real franchise.
Yeah.
You know? And the fact that it's lasted, you know, we're coming up on 50 years. I mean, it's just amazing.
That is crazy. You're right. Oh my God. And you know, honestly, I'm really glad that. Obviously, you've got, you know, respect for those original five, because really when Tim Burton came out with the new movie, he was really driving me crazy with a lot of his comments about it. And it's like, you know, we must have seen different films, man, because I got to say, Franklin Schaffner, the original director of the first film, mm-hmm. my God, when you see that first scene of the rustling of the cornfields and all the, you know, humans running away and you don't know what it's coming from, and then to all of a sudden see an ape on a horse with a gun show up. It really is this great cinematic moment. And I mean, you know, that's the thing. We all remember the lines about, you know, yeah, take your paws off me, you damn dirty ape, or it's a madhouse and damn you, you know, and pounding the sand around the Statue of Liberty. But amidst all of those great little sound bites and 2 second film clips, there's a really good movie here. And as you say, there's a lot of big ideas being expressed and ideas of their time. So it's really, that's the best kind of science fiction, is ones that really explore the human condition and do it with the backdrop and, you know, the puppets, if you will, of science fiction to represent real current issues and stuff. So that's going to be a fun place for you to explore.
Yeah, and that's really, I mean, that first movie really sets the bar high, because like you said, there are all these iconic moments. And, you know, to have those in combination with the ideas, just to deliver those eye kicks, you know, and still have time for to talk about, you know, important things. And not, I mean, I think Apes on Horseback are just awesome.
Sure.
But you can't make I don't think the franchise works if it's just a straight adventure where that's all there is and there's no commentary about what's going on politically or what this stuff means.
Is there, so as you say, now this is the time of the Lawgiver? Is this the time of the John Huston Lawgiver? Are there any other?
It is, yes.
Okay, so are there any other recognizable characters? I mean, he really only shows up at the beginning and the end of Battle, the fifth movie. And,
right.
And we've got his teachings. But yeah, I mean, so otherwise, is this a brand new slate of characters?
Yeah, otherwise, it's pretty much, because of the time period, it's a brand new slate of characters. The humans can still talk.
Sure.
We're going to explore that a little bit about what may be happening to them that would lead to that thing, you know, 1,000 years later, that they'd be mute. But so we've got the Lawgiver, and so we don't have the other characters because of the time period, but they are, like I said, they're sort of almost like biblical figures. So
sure.
All those characters from the past movies have this effect on the current society where people still talk about them and debate, like interpret their, you know, what they intended. And some of the apes will know. They haven't completely forgotten history yet. So a lot more of them will know about Cornelius and Zira and what they said and about what the future holds. And so some of them will be holding on to that knowledge and will be able to talk about that.
Okay, so that
I
legend,
even,
that legend of the that legend of the future then will exist in this time period in some
fashion.
Yeah,
it's almost like a Gnostic kind of knowledge, you know,
okay.
Held by some to, and so it'll shape, the main characters, and the main political argument going on is, like, one question I have is, let's say you have this distant future where basically the apes, except for their guns, seem to live almost entirely in an agrarian society. So my question is, you know, you've got you're about 2,000 years after the nuclear war. Why no scientific progress? What happened that would turn them away from that?
Sure.
Because 2,000 years is a long time. So one of the debates we'll have is, well, maybe you shouldn't be following in the human's footsteps. I mean, maybe that's the problem. Maybe there's a deliberate turn away from it. So we're setting this time period in the sort of the peak of ape-human society, at least technologically. We're sort of back up to the steam age, and they've got to make this decision about how far do they go with technology and its uses.
Oh, very interesting. And also the caste society is such an important thing in the ape films. And, you know, the orangutans are really kind of those who govern It seems like if there is intellectual curiosity, it's represented by the chimpanzees. And then, of course, you've got and then the warlike races, the gorillas, and they're the ones that seem to want to, you know, obviously protect whatever, I guess, is deemed the natural order as deemed by the orangutans. So, yeah, that should be interesting, and I'm sure you'll have key.
One of the things I want to play with, hopefully, you know, we'll have time to get around to all this, is those, because they're basically stereotypes. So you want to get into the fact, why is it the orangutans have just decided that they're the most wisest ones, and the gorillas are, like we call them gorillas. You know, why are they the thugs of the apes universe? Are there no thinking man's gorillas? so we're going to get into that as well, because it's not just apes versus humans, but there's sort of these divisions within ape society as well.
Are we going to see more than the three classes? That was one thing that I did like about Burton's film was obviously other kinds of apes were represented, and I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, I am bringing in bonobos, I've decided. So I'm bonobos are in. I've got my first bonobo in issue one, and we'll go from there. I think I'm out of the major apes at that point, but yeah.
All right. And, you know, I don't know if you ever read Warlord, the Mike Grell series, but it sounds, too, like we're going to see a cross again based on what you're telling me and the cover images that I've seen, that there is this cross of science and technology still existing in some sense from, you know, remnants of the past alongside the sword and sorcery kind of, you know, or at least swords, if not sorcery.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think the kind of, you know, technology level of maybe around the 1700s where you've got flintlocks, but it still made sense to carry swords around.
Okay.
You only got one shot off.
Right.
So there's going to be, let's call it pirate level technology.
Okay. Books always fascinated me because I guess in the books, really, it was even more 20th century technology when you got down to what Pierre Boulez was doing in the novel.
Oh, yeah. You know. He was basically drawing a sort of one-to-one comparison between – he just flipped current society.
Right.
It was more like
An O. Henry or a Twilight Zone where you don't really
–
In fact, the very end of the book is when, you know, that's the twist when you suddenly realize – you know, where the story is coming from and who is reading the story, the narrators. For people who may not have read the novel, there's a good twist at the end.
Yeah, and there's even some debate. People talk about, wow, why don't they just remake the novel itself? But it's a whole, you know, it's become, the ape movies themselves have become a whole different thing. And there were
true.
One nice thing about the internet, all the drafts of these scripts are out there, so you can see them sort of changing their mind as they went. You see, you know, from the original Rod Serling script to what they finally shot with.
Yeah.
It's just really interesting.
Yeah, you know, and I bought that book that, you know, I don't have the Blu-rays, but I have the DVDs, and I bought that special documentary DVD as well that Roddy McDowell narrates. And
oh, I'm jealous. I don't have that.
Oh, it's really cool. Although I'm surprised that's not part of the Blu-ray stuff. It's great. And, I mean, the book is better, though. And as you say, it really does talk about the first few attempts at scripts and what Serling tried to do and how he tried to match it to Boulez. And it's just for, you know, a 1960s film budget, it just became too expensive to kind of suggest some of the ideas that were in there. But, you know, it's funny that after the films, the cartoon, the Saturday morning cartoon, kind of resembled more of Boulez's book. And you saw apes in planes and you saw them in tanks and, you know, a kind of early or mid-20th century technology was going on in the – I don't know if you ever saw the old Planet of the Apes cartoon.
No, I never saw – and I've avoided – like I said, I avoided watching them because I was afraid to figure out because then the line is, how much do you adopt in? And so I sort of drew this line in the sand saying, all right, I'm going to do the five movies and then go from there.
Well, years from now, you should definitely dip into – was it Mr. Bang Comics or whatever, the Canadian publisher from about 5 years ago? Because that was a really interesting idea, and it really, you know, tried to fill that gap between the fourth movie and the fifth movie in particular. And I just thought,
oh, right. I have heard about those.
Yeah, they're kind of neat. And I was wondering, and you may not have the answer to this, I was going to ask Chip or one of the other guys at Boom, if given that they have the license, would they be putting out any of the old Marvel stuff, the old black and white stuff? Because a lot of times, I mean, we're seeing that now even with DC having the Doc Savage license, and a lot of the old Marvel 1970s Doc Savage stuff is coming out under the DC imprint while they have the license.
Uh-huh. No, I would like to know that myself. I didn't think to ask that question.
Well, right now you're the only 8-book. Yours is the only game in town for now.
That's right.
Very good.
Yeah, like, give me a couple months where I'm the only game.
I respect that. No problem, man. No, and again, I think it's smart to kind of set it where you're setting it, where there's a blank slate, so that's going to be a lot of fun to explore.
It's going to be that balance between, you know, you want to keep the traditional Planet of the Apes fans happy, but you still want to tell a new story and something interesting. So, people will tell us whether we've messed up or not.
So
I'm sure they'll be vocal about it. If we messed up that balance.
Well, the first story, 6 issues, is that what you're looking at, or?
It's a continuing series, so I've got a year.
Oh, fantastic!
And so, so we've got a year of outlines, and and so we're just going to go as long as people will let us.
Okay, and are these going to be 12 individual stories, or I mean, how do you have that first year mapped out as far as how many stories are we getting?
So we're going to do it's. It's going to be one continuous sort of arc. I'm sort of dividing it up between every 4 issues, allowing a jumping on space for readers.
Okay.
But in general, there's an overall arc of, like the first arc is called The Long War. And we're going to be dealing with the insurrection from the humans inside this ape-human city. And we're going to just keep rolling that out politically. And one of the things we can do in the comics that I think is cool is, because we don't have these budget constraints, is we can do an actual Planet of the Apes. We can keep rolling this out. My general plan is constant escalation. So I'm going to start with this one sort of sprawling city and start with the insurrection there. And then we'll just keep rolling. And and hopefully we'll have time to just make the world richer and richer as we bring in, because it doesn't start in the Forbidden City. We're starting in a new city, but the Forbidden City is still there. We'll later be, and Ape City's there, the Forbidden Zone. So we'll keep bringing in old stuff, including the mutants are going to be there. We're going to bring them in.
Terrific.
We're just going to try to use everything.
Well, that's a good point, too, because, you're right. The films really did kind of focus in on, you know, obviously North America and everything, and really didn't even examine the ideas of, well, what happened in the rest of the planet? And, you know, who's to say that, you know, there might be pockets of resistance or just a different, balance and stuff. Absolutely. No, that's really neat. Cool.
What are the apes in China doing?
Right. Absolutely.
Did the pandas? The pandas picked this up. So yeah.
Oh God, that'd be awesome. There you go, Planet of the Apes pandas. I like it. Good idea, man. That's very funny. Very funny. What can you tell me about your artist?
Oh, Carlos Magno. He's. I can't wait for people to see what he's done, because he's just his pencils are so beautiful. I almost hated to see them colored in, because his apes and his humans are so beautiful. But he also does action really well. So there's a couple nice set pieces we have that I think people will really like. And no, he's just an amazing guy. And they've done a lot of work with the color palette. It's trying to get that right mood, because one of the things about the Planet of the Apes movies is they get pretty dark, and they're serious movies. So we want to get that seriousness of purpose down in the color palette, in Carlos's art. They're taking a lot of care with this one. There are a lot of thinking through all the. All the artistic elements and the script. It's been really interesting.
Now, as we said earlier, there is a new movie that's in production. And again, this is a licensed, property from Fox. So what kind of, parameters and conversations have you had in terms of what you've set up as far as stories and things like that? And, is it tough kind of getting your arcs approved through the Fox, people?
No, my experience has been really good, mostly because Boom is sheltering me from that. Maybe they're actually protecting Fox from me. So what the process was is I wrote up sort of my pitch for what I wanted to do. what the general outline is and the scope of the story, what the time period was, what characters I wanted to use. And then through some mysterious process, which they hid from me, it came back and said, okay, Fox says that's okay. And then and they're seeing the first script and the first issues, and it's unclear to me how involved they will be. And I think it probably depends on what Fox's attention level is. I'm totally guessing here.
Okay.
But with the reboot movie happening with Franco, it may be that they'll say, "Oh, it's going fine. The sales are fine." And then they quietly ignore us, and we get weirder and weirder without them noticing. this is probably going to give the Boom people a heart attack. I probably even shouldn't say that aloud. But yeah, wouldn't it be great to get even weirder as we go along?
Well, that's good. And I remember Marvel having, they certainly went their own direction back in the day with Star Wars. And having no idea.
Oh, right.
They were told certain things in terms of what they could and couldn't do as things progressed. But, a lot of times it was after the fact. I remember Walter Simonson telling me that they had, or maybe it was Dave Michelinie, I'm not sure, one of the two, that they finally had Luke confronting Vader, and it was in the comic book. And then is when the word from Lucasfilms came and said, oh, no, wait, they can't see each other yet. So literally, like, Vader was, like, sucked out of an airlock or whatever. I mean, the next issue. Or it turned out it was a hologram of Vader, and it really wasn't Vader that was there. So,
I got to imagine that's a tougher franchise to work because you just get the feeling that, they're much more serious about the entire Bible. I've heard stories of friends who've worked on, like, novelizations and the amount of story approval that they go through.
Sure.
But my experience so far, and like I said, this is probably Boom protecting me from it, has been, hey, go write your stories, and let's we've got approval, so let's roll.
Very cool, excellent, man. And you mentioned earlier that you worked on the Dracula series with Kurt Busiek for Boom.
Yeah, that was great. That was a great way to come into comics. Is basically Kurt Busiek had this outline and the storyline for Dracula Company of Monsters, and he said, I don't have time to write this, so can you grab somebody? And that's when Chris put my name up. I'm not exactly sure how it happened, but I'm not asking any questions because I got in the door. So it's like, however you decided to hire me, I'm there for you. And that was a fantastic learning experience because I come from the world of novels. Mm-hmm. And even though I've been reading comics all my life, just learning the craft of pacing and structure, it was just an amazing learning experience. So that was a blast. Even, a novelist, he's not used to thinking of things like, you can only have a two-page spread when you turn the page, you can't put a two-page spread across a page turn. So
right.
It's got to be even odd.
Sure.
Like, the actual physical reading experience has an effect on what you can do. that's something that prose guys don't have any conception of. We just keep writing and writing and writing until we just exhaust ourselves.
Understood. Now you go to your website, DarylGregory.com, and you can see all of Daryl's novels there. Pandemonium, The Devil's Alphabet.
Yep, and I got a third book coming out in June called Raising Stony Mayhall, my anti-zombie novel, zombie novel.
Well, good. I was about to say I'm all for anti. I mean, and taking nothing away from Boom Zone work on 28 Days Later and Kirkman's Walking Dead. Those are great zombie stories. But, man, I got to tell you, every convention I get a guy walking up to me and going, I got a zombie comic. And my eyes start rolling into the back of my head. And I turn into a zombie and just kind of amble away.
I decided there were so many zombie things coming out, and when I first pitched this book, it wasn't quite the overwhelming tsunami of zombie stuff that was out. So I started writing it, but it was always pitched as I wanted to write the Unforgiven of zombie novels. Like when I watched Unforgiven, I thought that's it for westerns. We're done.
Sure,
there's nothing left to say. Every cliche has been overturned, and we're dead. So that's basically the whole pitch behind Raising Stony Mayhall is I thought I'm going to write my one zombie novel. I'm going to do everything I want to do and try to kill the genre, which of course is impossible. and And who would want to when you've got, like, Chris Robertson's, like, iZombie, which is just a beautiful, fun
comic. You're absolutely right, and that is a fun comic book as well.
So it just goes to show you that, you know, like, I never thought vampires would last this long. but they keep coming out.
Yeah.
And so I guess there's really no limitation if you can tell a, you know, if you can tell a good story. But I had the same reaction, too. I wrote the novel almost as a reaction against all those zombie things coming out.
Well, the good news is the ape world has been very quiet for, you know, about 5 years now. So it's about time for a resurrection.
Strike.
Resurrection of the Apes. Feel free to use that for one of the titles.
Yeah, well, those are the next arc. Actually, it should have been the first arc.
That's all right, man.
Planet of the Apes Resurrection should have been it.
So we're looking forward to this book now. Again, likely, as you're hearing this, the book is probably already out on the stands. And it sounds like a great idea. And I'm really glad that Boom has the opportunity to exploit the property. And it sounds like it's in good hands. So, Daryl Gregory, good luck to you with this story. And,
thanks a lot, John. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. And, really look forward to it. And believe me, I'm a hardcore ape fan. So,
I can tell.
The Forbidden Zone.
You
might have an email from the Forbidden Zone and stuff, you know, an underground mutant like myself letting you know, hey, wait a minute, man. What the hell are you doing? No, it's going to be great, man. So good luck. And, yeah, I look forward to reading it. So congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
That's Daryl Gregory. Thanks again. Also, make sure you check out Boom Studios' Planet of the Apes. Issue 1 has sold out, so rush to your store and see if they might have a copy or not. But I imagine that with that success that they will do some sort of second printing. And it's a great start to the story. I really enjoyed it. Plus, check out that Rise of the Planet of the Apes trailer that Fox has out. I think the James Franco movie looks very interesting. And I think, like you said, the Ape franchise seems to be in very good hands. So great to see some new Planet of the Apes stuff. Always happy to have more Ape Talk here at Word Balloon. Today's episode was brought to you by the Word Balloon T-shirt. That's right. If you go to wordballoon.com, check out what we have for you, the Word Balloon T-shirt. It was designed by Tim Seeley, and it's reasonably priced. It's just $20, $3.95 for shipping and handling. Please allow 4 to 5 weeks for delivery. And thanks to everyone who has ordered the shirt so far. I thank you, and the reason why we have that 4 to 5 weeks is we have already begun to run out in certain sizes, but the supplier is available to get more. So, and as we always like to point out, the plus-size people, we're your pals here at Word Balloon. We don't charge you extra money for those plus sizes. John Sutra saying thanks again for listening to Word Balloon. It's been a very busy April. May will be the same. Lots of great interviews coming up. I cannot wait to start doling out some of the shows that are already in the can for Word Balloon. It's a great lineup, and I think you're going to enjoy May just as much as we've enjoyed April. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2011.